Welcome to Into Africa. My name is Judd Devermont. I am the director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I was the National Intelligence Officer for Africa and worked at the National Security Council. This is a podcast where we talk politics and challenge paradigms.
On deck today, Mozambique has allowed Rwanda and Southern African troops to deploy to the rest of Cabo Delgado region. Will it reduce the level of violence? And Burundi's president is mending relations with the country's neighbors. Will his foreign policy serve as a distraction from the troubling developments within the country? Plus, we talk about U.S. and Chinese engagement with African security chiefs. What does it tell us about Washington and Beijing's objectives in the African security sector?
So whether you have a history with the continent or you're a newcomer, we want to get you into Africa.
Mozambican President Philippe Nyusi has agreed that Rwandan and Southern African forces will help his government fight the northern insurgency.
Rwanda has deployed troops to Mozambique to help the country combat the escalating insurgency. According to the Rwandan government, the troops will join forces with Mozambique and others for the SADC region.
Will this foreign deployment help or hinder efforts to restore security in the Cabo Delgado region? Joining me to discuss Mozambique and other topics are retired Vice Admiral Michael Franken, former AFRICOM Deputy Commander, Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the African Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and Bonnie Lin, a senior fellow for Asian Security and director of the China Power Project at CSIS. Okay, on July 10th, Mozambican President Nyusi publicly confirmed that 1,000 Rwandan troops and police had begun deploying to Cabo Delgado in northern Mozambique, and that a Southern African Development Community, or SADC, standby force would it follow. Now, Paul, your organization, ACSS, my organization, CSIS, has written a lot about the crisis in Mozambique. In fact, I think our last podcast was maybe in May, and we talked about what was going on in Mozambique. We also had a discussion with the Human Rights Watch, Zenaida Machado, on our new podcast, 49. So there's a lot of people who are thinking about this issue and the challenges, the opportunities. And I would love to get your thoughts. Is this a game changer? What are the pitfalls? Can this actually deliver peace to the region, or at least fight back the insurgency? What are the ways that you've been thinking about this?
Thank you, Judd. I think it is a step in the direction of giving practical effect to the idea of African solutions to African problems. This is a mantra that the African Union has been advancing for many years. There have been efforts to operationalize the African Standby Force and its various regional standby brigades. So this is a test case. 3 years ago, the African Union and the Southern African Development Community held a brigade-level peacekeeping and peace enforcement exercise in South Africa. And there's been a lot of discussion within the peace and security community on the continent that, you know, there's all this training, capacity building, preparation, early warning. But when are these forces actually going to deploy into a real conflict situation? An opportunity was lost in Burundi. So in Mozambique, there is some optimism that finally we're now starting to see the pieces of the Africa Standby Force coming together. It remains to be seen how effective they'll be on the ground operationally. As far as I understand, in terms of the concept of operations, this is a combat force. There'll be need for interoperability. There's also an external element to it in the sense that the Rwandese have already deployed actually ahead of the SADC forces. It remains to be seen whether the Rwandans will coordinate with their South African counterparts in the field. But it's certainly a step in the direction of putting meat on the Africa Standby Force.
I think that's such an important point. You know, not only are the Rwandans already there, but just at the time of this recording in sort of late July, the South Africans and the Botswanans have deployed. I believe Lesotho is going to join. And so it's really interesting to me that there's a number of countries that we don't think as peacekeepers that are getting into the mix and developing capacity. But you hit the nail right on the head, Paul. How are they all going to work together? Still, I think, lingering questions about the Mozambican forces, their capacity. Will they pull back on some of the human rights abuses? And will all of this, even if they make progress in terms of dealing with the insurgency, will they address the underlying drivers of this conflict? And one of those are going to have to be thinking about civilian protection. I'd recommend that listeners check out this new commentary by Emily Colombo, who is our senior associate, and Kelly Moss, who is a part of the humanitarian agenda where we talk about these issues. But I thought, Admiral Franken, where does this put the U.S.? So there is already a small deployment, maybe about a dozen Army Green Berets that are training the Marines. That's going to go on for about 2 months. Just recently, Secretary Blinken confirmed that the U.S. was going to support Mozambique in a call with President Nussi. But, you know, if you were back in Stuttgart and thinking about this deployment, what are the questions that you would ask? And how would you approach a U.S. partnership to address some of these really serious issues in the region?
Well, I think the first thing we need to address is what's the appetite for the United States to get involved in this overseas contingency. And for the United States' perspective, this changes over time and conditions and is reflective of internal politics. But this isn't like something as shallow as a pursuit for Joseph Kony in Central African Republic and South Sudan. This is more of a regional issue that the United States has an identifiable need and a history that we must pursue. The rationale for U.S. interests has become almost myopic, I would say. And we must have a U.S. business, and we must ensure that President Biden knows unequivocally what's the desired end state. And going back to even the Reagan administration, who saw that the strategically located nation of Mozambique needed to have a fair shot at finding its natural prominence. And should AFRICOM help? Absolutely. And how would we do this? Well, first and foremost, you must get the big strategy right. What's the desired end state? And do you have the policy underpinnings to execute that strategy? And secondly, how do you accomplish at the molecular level? Who do you talk with? How? Where? What's the trade space in the discussion? So yes, I do think that AFRICOM ought to get involved. Now, the last time I was there, I believe in 2016 or 17, we saw this as a necessity and also that it was going, unfortunately, south. I think the United States rather took a back seat to the European contributors, and that's perhaps unfortunate. But this situation, from a security perspective, will not heal itself. And there are similarities to the Boko Haram in Nigeria situation. This is not an organization that is philosophical. It is more based on a criminal element. And ultimately, it's going to require a security aspect in step with a humanitarian. And it falls to the old adage that the distance from the capital is inversely proportional to the security and the political bandwidth of the region. And I would be ever so happy if the United States followed through with Anthony Blinken's statements.
I think it's so important to be clear about the end state, because I think if we look at some of the other counterterrorism operations that we've been involved in, the end state, maybe it's sort of aspirationally talking about degrade, defeat an extremist group, but sometimes that's not as practical, or at least you can't really build a strategy based on that. I think you alluded to this, Admiral. You have to understand the trade space, right? And how do you rack and stack this challenge in northern Mozambique with the efforts that we have in the Sahel or the Lake Chad Basin or in the Horn of Africa? And I don't expect you to litigate that on this podcast, but this has got to be part of the calculation too. Our forces, our resources are finite. And how do we think about what we can do here and how we should do it? And in partnership has got to be a huge part of the calculus.
Well, yes. I've always thought Mozambique was a maritime nation. This is not a negative thing, but there are business interests associated with Mozambique. And we also saw humanitarian. The PEPFAR program in Mozambique is so helpful to the citizenry. And I would concentrate on looking at child development, what's best for female health, and infrastructure. I believe any kind of force that goes into the region, the image is they're building something, they're giving something back. And a situation like Mozambique, back in when I was last there, I urged them, I implored with them, look at which industries you need to support your security apparatus. Build those industries. We will help you, and we will employ your people and ensure it's something that's self-sustaining. But yes, I do think we're going to do this, and I hope the United States racks this in the top five for AFRICOM. And I hope that we follow through with a comprehensive government approach where military takes a backseat to development and diplomacy.
Yeah, I absolutely concur. Why don't we move to our next topic, which is Burundi? I think the last time we talked about Burundi on the podcast, President Nkurunziza had just allegedly died of COVID-19, and Evariste Ndayishimiye, who had won the election, was installed a little bit early as the president because of his predecessor's death.
When President Evariste Ndayishimiye was sworn in June, he vowed to ensure national unity, peace and social justice. But UN investigators say that's not happening, dashing hopes of change under a new government.
And we're so fortunate to have Paul here to have this quick conversation about, you know, how's it going so far? And there's been some continuity in terms of harassment of the political opposition, still clashes with rebel groups. But what I wanted to talk about is that the president has done a lot to mend relationships with neighbors. He's even gone so far as to prompt the UN to officially close the office of the UN Secretary General Special Envoy to Burundi. So, Paul, what is your assessment? I mean, are his gestures, do they merit the resumption of international relations? I mean, is this meaningful reform or just window dressing? How are you interpreting these events?
Well, you know, Burundi is one of those countries that is now off the radar, but certainly not out of the woods yet. Nevertheless, President Ndayishimiye has prioritized repairing diplomatic relations, especially with his neighbors, because he does face military pressure. He faces military pressure from a rebellion that is growing, even though it's just outside the radar in terms of media coverage. He's facing a lot of political pressure because the groups that are opposed to the government continue that opposition. The refugees are not returning. The situation is not safe. And the militias are still operational in the country. And essentially what you have in Burundi is a military government. Ndayishimiye, we should remember, belongs to a faction within the military that took over after the death of the former president. So certainly the situation has not changed fundamentally. I think one of the critical elements is the dismantlement of the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement. And these accords were the framework for sustainable and inclusive security sector reform in Burundi. For the first time in decades, the country's military was seen as representative of all components of the nation. These elements were in place to ensure an apolitical military and a military that is loyal to the constitution and to the Arusha Accords. That has been dismantled. And it's very important that the region and the international community takes note and tries to arrest that situation before we get another surprise. You know, Burundi is a country that goes under the radar, and then after a few months, something flares up. So I think that's something that we need to look out for. The other element with President Ndayishimiye is that he hasn't just reached out to his regional partners. He's been talking to the Rwandese, the Ugandans, the Kenyans. He's also applied to join the Southern African Development Community. And it will be interesting to see how the SADC leaders will respond to that initiative.
So I'm going to paraphrase, Paul. I mean, one is don't believe the hype. And the second one is that our relationship with Burundi, and there's a lots of countries I think that fit in this box, when we either decide the case is closed or that it's manageable and take our eye off the ball, we end up facing a surprise and dealing with a much more severe crisis. And I think that's been the case for Burundi in particular, that we sort of, okay, it's a crisis now, it's simmered down, so we're not going to focus on it. And I do think that, as you point out, the human rights abuses are continuing. And one of the facets that I don't want to say is a reason for paying attention to Burundi, but I've been really interested in this, is that China's relationship with Burundi continues to evolve. Now, this is super dorky, but back in the 1960s, China's involvement in Burundi was something that the U.S. government paid attention to. I've read some declassified documents where it talks about analyzing the role of the Chinese communists in the 1960s and fearing that China would benefit from certain coups. And that may seem like ancient history, but here we are in 2021, and President Xi has only talked to four African leaders this year: Macky Sall of Senegal, Julius Maada Bio of Sierra Leone, Samia Suluhu Hassan of Tanzania, and the president of Burundi. And I don't know, Bonnie, I'm not expecting you to be an expert on Burundi, but what does a call from Xi mean? What does that tell us about the way that Beijing thinks about this country?
Thank you, Judd. I think it's important before talking about the call to mention that this call builds on a strong relationship China already has with Burundi, which China calls an all-weather friend. That's a slogan that China uses for China's closest partners. Taking this back a little bit in history, if you look at visits by top Chinese leaders to Africa since 2017, Burundi has made it on the Chinese itinerary 2 times, which is actually quite impressive for a country of its size. During the March 29th call that you're referring to, Chinese President Xi Jinping stated that China-Burundi relations have become, from China's perspective, a model of South-South cooperation. And I think there are several reasons for this from the Chinese end. One is Burundi is a member of China's Belt and Road Initiative, and China is investing quite a bit of infrastructure there, including building a railroad that will link the country with other Chinese infrastructure projects. The two countries also have various agricultural cooperation projects. Burundi also publicly supports China on a range of issues that are becoming increasingly contentious for Beijing. This includes, for example, China's positions and policies on Taiwan, Xinjiang, South China Sea, as well as Hong Kong. It's also worth noting that China is likely eyeing Burundi's natural resources, such as nickel and rare earths, which are key for its high-tech manufacturing. Burundi is one of the top 10 producers of rare earth minerals and exports most of its minerals to China. And I think what's interesting about this call that Xi had with the Burundi president is that it occurred after the Myanmar coup, which took place in February. Myanmar was previously China's leading supplier of rare earths, and it's possible that as we're moving into late March, Beijing was worried about its ability to import rare earths from Myanmar, given the continuing crisis there, and as a result, caused China to think more about other countries that China was importing this key mineral from.
That's fascinating. I don't think I had put all that together, Bonnie. Thank you for that. Paul, an expert on China-Africa and an expert on Burundi, you have to have thoughts on this. Is there anything that you want to build on what Bonnie said, or can you help us kind of put Burundi in perspective as you see it for Beijing?
Yes, and Bonnie, you are spot on. There is ideological and historical ties between China and Burundi, and these ties are, as you said, Judd, this is not ancient history. Ideological ties, history of backing liberation movements is something that China and its African partners frequently invoke in all their meetings, when they sign documents, when African countries send their officials to China for training. This is a major talking point. So the Burundians have very, very cleverly used that kind of rhetoric in recent years, particularly after the country started facing isolation by way of sanctions, both from the European Union as well as countries like the United States. And so it is part of that strategy to ensure that Burundi remains relevant on the international scene. China is pretty much the only country, and to some extent North Korea, that are able to extend that lifeline to Burundi. So that's the first element. The second element is economic. I mean, Burundi might be a small country, but it's very strategic in terms of the region that it occupies. The border with the DRC, this is a region that has rare earth minerals and important raw materials for China, both in terms of cost, also in terms of access. And given that relationship, the Chinese have been extremely efficient and strategic in the manner in which they've engaged the Burundian government. But the third reason doesn't really have anything to do with Burundi, but is more in line with China's broader message. The message that China would like to send to its African partners is that China is an all-weather friend. Regardless of sanctions they face by other international partners, they can continue to rely on China. African countries can continue to rely on China, regardless of their political systems, regardless of the types of conflicts they're facing, and the sorts of relationships they have with Western powers. So I think these are the three broad strategic elements that apply to China's relationship with the regime in Burundi.
Thanks, Paul. And that's a perfect transition, because we're going to talk about China's all-weather engagement for our final section. I'm really excited to dig into this new report that we've just published, Personal Ties, Measuring Chinese and U.S. Engagement with Senior African Security Chiefs. So with the help of our program's research associate, Mariel Harris, and some important input from Professor Lina Ben-Abdullah and Allison Albeda, we built a database of Chinese and U.S. contacts with 454 incumbent chiefs of defense staff, Chiefs of Army Staff, Chiefs of Naval Staff, Chiefs of Air Staff, Chiefs of Police, as well as their immediate predecessors for 53 African countries. And I'm going to walk through some of the top line conclusions, but I actually found them to be really surprising, and we'll kind of dig into them as the episode goes along. But here they are briefly. We found that the United States has engaged with more current and former African security chiefs, 43% of the database, compared to China, which only was about 19%. The United States engages way more with chiefs of naval staff than China does. Maybe Admiral Franken, that's because of you. We can talk about that. Whereas China privileges chiefs of police more than the United States does. When it comes to regions, the United States engages more in West Africa, whereas China operates more in Southern Africa. And then we created a definition of high impact activities, which essentially means, are the activities one that the individual African security chief believes could help advance their professional or personal objectives and career? And so under this high impact section, Beijing's was by far its sales and its donations, whereas for the United States, it was much more about training. So we're not going to be able to talk about all of the aspects of the report. I really encourage you to check out our website, but I thought the three of you have unique perspectives to bring to this, and we can kind of flesh out some of the ideas. And Admiral Franken, I'd like to start with you because the U.S. does really well in this report. When I started it, I thought it would be the opposite, that China would be doing much more engagement at the senior levels. But as you read through the report, what was your thoughts on why there was this consistently high level of engagement? And maybe you can just add, what is the strategic value for the United States of this people-to-people engagement, again, at this very senior level of African security chiefs?
Well, I believe that the level of U.S. participation is reflective of the realization that Africa as a continent is on its ascendancy. It's much more significant player internationally in both the human capital potential and its business arena. The natural resources, its geolocation, its transit lanes for commerce, its agriculture, its stock is rising. Gone are the days of the Bush administration where the national security documents gave Africa short shrift if it was mentioned at all.
Bonnie, is that the way that China thinks about this engagement? If Beijing is focused on developing these relationships with senior African chiefs, albeit not as robustly as the U.S. is, I mean, what do you think about explaining how China is engaging with African security chiefs? I found that their focus on Southern Africa was a bit surprising. And if you have any reaction to that, and or maybe do you think it's going to change in the future, I think that would be really useful to hear.
I think there are likely a number of objectives for Chinese military engagement with African security chiefs. This includes, for example, protecting Chinese people and investments abroad. And this might explain why China has placed much emphasis on relations with chiefs of police. Other Chinese goals include, for example, expanding PLA connections, operations, and military access, particularly as the Chinese military seeks to become a world-class military. I will also add that the PLA needs to support larger Chinese political and strategic goals. So I would not be surprised if some of this PLA activity that we're seeing are winning general goodwill and political support from African military leaders to either support China's global or regional efforts, or at least ensure that African leaders do not join Western criticism of China. I think your report does a really good job at explaining why China has engaged the most with Southern African countries. And this is, as your report notes, due to the history of China's engagement with the region, as well as the region was experiencing liberation struggles. Your report also mentions the Belt and Road Initiative and how such priorities also shape Chinese involvement. In 2019, the Southern African Development Community had affirmed its plan to link BRI with its industrialization strategy. So looking forward, we may see China increase its engagements with coastal countries in Eastern Africa to try to gain more access, particularly another access point to the Indian Ocean. And Judd, I know you've done some quite amazing work looking at China's investment in sub-Saharan ports. So one of the major ports in Tanzania that China was supposed to operate, fund, and build that you identified as stalled in your 2019 report appears to be back in play. And I think we should closely track that development there. And it could be another one of those investments where China might see at least a dual-use purpose. But moving forward, I see more Chinese activity, particularly on the eastern side of Africa. And I think that very much aligns with your findings from your report.
I agree with you. I mean, we say it in the report that a focus towards East Africa, and the definition of East Africa that we use is the African unions, which means that that not only includes Ethiopia and Kenya, but it includes the islands where there's a lot of competition in the Indo-Pacific. And then West Africa is a place where I think that they're probably going to go as well, particularly around piracy, but also some of the biggest economies like Nigeria or the mineral resources. So the report poses the question that we may be at an inflection point when it comes to regional preferences for China in this engagement. Paul, reflecting on Bonnie's comments and Admiral Franken's comments, How do you think about these types of security partnerships? And I should say, if I could give someone like a note on being like an unofficial author of this report, it may be you, because the work that you've done, the congressional testimonies have really informed my thinking about this as well. So I'd love to get your impressions, help explain how Africa thinks about these engagements.
I think what I would say is that there could be some issues that were hidden in terms of trying to get a sense of the numbers of engagements the Chinese People's Liberation Army has with African officers, for the simple reason that a lot of these engagements are actually not in uniform. Many of these military exchanges that China has with African countries are done under political platforms, under platforms organized by the Communist Party of China. And as you know, the Chinese system, the party commands the gun. All military activities and engagements are done and supervised by the Communist Party of China. So a lot of African professionals who go to China for training or participate in Chinese training on the African continent do so as senior civilians, not necessarily uniformed officers. So I think more research is required to really unpack this aspect of Chinese engagement. You also have political commissars. Some African countries like Uganda still use political commissars, Mozambique to some extent, Angola as well, Zimbabwe. But I think more broadly, one of the lessons that China learned from the era of the liberation movements is that it doesn't need a military-heavy approach to generate the kind of influence it requires in Africa. I mean, if you compare PLA deployments and Cuban deployments, for instance, at some point the Cubans were reaching at least 400,000 troops on the ground in Southern Africa, mostly deployed to assist the Namibian Liberation Forces, the Angolan government, and the ANC. One of the things you find is that the Chinese deployment really did not exceed 20,000 troops at the most. And none of them were involved in combat roles. But when you talk about countries that contributed to African independence and African liberation movements, Cuba is hardly ever mentioned. In fact, even the Soviet Union is hardly ever mentioned in the ways in which China is mentioned. The reason for that is that China adopted a very blended approach where the PLA was very complementary to so-called soft power, cultural soft power, and political influence operations. I think this is a huge lesson that China learned in that era, and it is a lesson that China continues to apply. So if you compare Chinese deployments, for instance, bases and that sort of thing, with the United States, China lags far behind. However, China does generate tremendous influence and a tremendous political clout by using the PLA sparingly and focusing more on political objectives. A very good example was the negotiations that led to the opening of the base in Djibouti. Now, this is very significant because less than a year before that base was opened, the African Union Peace and Security Council issued a statement warning African countries of entering into arrangements that would introduce more foreign bases on the continent. And less than a year later, you know, the Chinese had established a base in Djibouti. If you look at what China had done in the years preceding this decision, there was the Peace and Security Fund that was offered to operationalize the African standby force. There was the African Union headquarters. There was a sharp increase in the number of scholarships and fellowships and professional exchanges that China was offering African countries. I mean, as we speak, 100,000 quotas are offered to African countries. So there was a series of steps that China took that made it all but impossible to imagine that the African Union or African countries would have been opposed to the opening of that military base. So I think when we look at Chinese military engagement, we need to look at it from the perspective of that blended approach. The Chinese seem to believe, at least for now, that they can achieve their objectives by using the PLA very sparingly, very calculatively, but also very strategically in ways that advance larger diplomatic goals. In terms of African attitudes to Chinese military training and compared to the kind of training they receive in the United States, what you hear anecdotally is that the US training is much more relevant. First of all, the qualifications are recognized internationally. Secondly, the qualifications are very attractive when these officers retire and they're able to get appointments to serve on peacekeeping missions and to serve on, you know, multilateral security operations. A qualification from the National War College or from the Naval Postgraduate School goes a long way. And there's just no comparison in terms of similar qualifications from the PLA National Defense University, at least for now. That is what African officers say. But at the same time, they say that the Chinese training is much more relevant at the lower levels. So you're looking at, you know, IT, you look information technology, military medicine, you look at machinery, equipment, you know, servicing. The Chinese offering is seen to be much more relevant at that level. U.S. training is appreciated at the strategic level. This is what we are hearing, but I think the empirical research is still very thin.
I think this last point that you made is so important. We just cite you in the report because I think that too often U.S. policymakers think that what we do is sort of uniformly viewed as higher quality. And I think what you're saying here is there's a nuance there, depending on the level, the officer type. And I think that's important to think about. The second point that you made that's really important, and we say as well, is that China's military activities are part of, not separate from, these broader goals. And we have to think about it in that respect. And then I'll just make two caveats that are important here. One is that you're absolutely right, Paul. There's only so much that we can count. There's only so much that's observable. Our view in the report is that there's still value in doing that, in part because what is China or the U.S. trying to convey with these engagements in the public eye? And that's really interesting because you find that China's narrative around its engagements when they are making public statements are a little discordant with how they visually portray it. So the Chinese engagements, obviously, friendship, partnership, you know, things that you would expect, but almost all the pictures are of the weapons, the ships. Maybe there's a Chinese official who's sort of observing African officers, you know, standing in line, whereas the U.S. tends to have pictures of Africans and U.S. soldiers together. It's sort of a little more consonant with the imagery, although I tell you both the Chinese and the U.S. are not using platforms that are well-read. The U.S. is almost exclusively on our own websites, and the Chinese are almost exclusively on Xinhua or CGTN, which don't get as close of a read as others do. So I think there's a lot to unpack. But just to wrap up our episode, what are things that we should watch out for? What are things that either country or African country should do to refine their approach? I mean, I'll make it more of a grab bag. But Bonnie, why don't you start us off?
Sure. Thank you, Judd. I actually wanted very much to follow on Paul's really good point that China is very strategic about how it uses its PLA, and PLA is used to support larger political and strategic goals. So with respect to what that means in terms of what the United States could do, I want to first go what Judd wrote in the report, which is the United States already has strong security ties in the region, and the United States should not think that we need to beat China in every possible metric in Africa. That will not serve U.S. long-term goals. But if you look at what China's trying to do with the PLA in terms of the larger political strategic goals, I think one aspect of activity that hasn't been as publicized, but probably does win China a good bit of goodwill, is the PLA deliveries of COVID aid to Africa in the past year or so. It hasn't been a large amount. It's been symbolic, but I believe that has helped win goodwill among military leaders. And I have to wonder, from the U.S. perspective, our military could be more involved in doing that. So our military engagement with the region doesn't have to be military to military, right? And here, I think our military could probably do more in terms of helping with providing vaccines to the region, but also using the significant expertise we have on the logistics side to help African countries distribute the vaccines that they already have.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I will add, though, Bonnie, when it comes to presenting what we're doing on COVID-19, the military has been far better than the State Department or USAID. That's changing a little bit now under Administrator Power, but it's AFRICOM that has the best visuals. It's AFRICOM that's the one that's, you know, handing over, at least in the earlier period, PPEs and ventilators, building field hospitals, whereas the State Department and other elements of the U.S. government were largely just doing fact sheets that talked about money, but nothing that was sort of tangible and concrete. So I agree that the AFRICOM and the military could do more, but I just want to give a heads up that, at least in my view, the most sort of public affairs component of this, I think AFRICOM had been doing the best. Paul, let me turn to you if you have any additional comments you want to add as we wrap up.
Thank you very much. And Bonnie, great points. It is a great paper, Judd. It's a great paper. But if there was one thing I would like to point out that the United States could think about more critically is essentially looking at how the PLA's activities break down. in practice. So, you know, between 2000 and 2016, for instance, the PLA on the African continent conducted 13 joint military exercises, 22 naval port calls, and 259 exchanges and dialogues. These are people-to-people professional exchanges, leader-to-leader exchanges. Now, what this tells us is that the PLA is still placing a lot of emphasis on relationship building, on trust, on networking. And a lot of this also comes from its history during the liberation struggles in Africa. So I think this is one area that the United States probably needs to think about in terms of where the PLA is likely to go over the next 5 to 10 years. I think if you look at that from the broader perspective, this is the message that China, as a government, is sending to the African continent, that relationships matter, trust matters, and ideology matters. It doesn't surprise me that the PLA is moving in this direction or that the PLA has been focusing on this ever since it got involved in Africa. And the party prioritizes having what they call all-round relationships with civilian and military professionals on the continent. So I think that is something by way of recommendation that we need to look at more closely and see what kind of competencies would be available to the United States to be able to increase its engagements on the continent and with Africans.
That's really helpful, Paul. Admiral Franken, let me give you the last word.
Well, a couple of short groups. Regarding the Chinese proclivity to train police forces over military, I think that reflects their mercantile side of things, where they look for the rule of law to ensure that business is maintained. They want to train the police. The U.S. on the low level is in the expansion of quality of life. On the high level of matters, it's the international good relations. It's the diplomatic, humanitarian, health issues. The Chinese court the business elites. The U.S. works on a different stratum of society. Regarding a more refined approach to security sector engagement, I think we need to work to develop sustaining industries, microgrid technologies, the health substructures. In Djibouti, the president asked me, when I asked him what I could do for him, he said, make my country live longer. Well, on that initiative, that's pretty identifiable. We made living quarters, health clinics, and schools all co-located, 13 locations in the country, and then doubled the expansion of the medical university. The training that the U.S. military provides our African partners, I don't like the vision of a U.S. military person leaning over the shoulder teaching someone how to shoot an AK-47. I would rather look at the law of armed conflict, the rules and consequences, and the high-level thought, training for leadership, and how to run a uniform service efficiency with a high level of efficacy. Regarding health substructures, work on eye clinics and dental clinics, not so much for adults, but for the youth, and bring in local doctors, pay them for their time to work with us after we spend a training session to ensure that they are following the protocols that we are obligated to do, and so that we don't take business away from them. Concentrate on female health, pay doctors again to participate. And regarding interfacing with training, be very conscious of the language you use. The Chinese don't teach their partners Mandarin. They try to teach either indigenous languages or speak in English. That doesn't translate so well. We have the benefit there, but we must ensure that our training sticks. Let me also mention that why we concentrate on navies versus armies is navies require a national commitment. Armies can be stood up much more quickly. We want to indeed be an all-weather friend, and being sensible about it is job number one.
Well, I'm honored to be with the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll see everyone in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening. We want to have more conversations about Africa. Tell your friends, subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you find good content. You can also check out our analysis and reports at csis.org/Africa. Thanks.